Senate State Affairs come together on this fine morning on the 26th of March, 9 a.m. We have members present, Senator Huggins, Stoltz, and Vice Chair Coghill. We have some bills that have been backed up on here. We'll jump right into, we have a groundbreaking piece of legislation we need to dispense with today, so. We have a deadline impending for this to be more relevant, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Jeff Turner, staffer, Representative Charisse Nowak, who apologizes for not being able to attend today's hearing. She's hosting the House Majority News Conference this morning. House Bill 35 is before you. On March 27th, 1964, South Central Alaska was torn apart, as many of you know, as you all know, by a 9.2 magnitude earthquake. It devastated 50,000 square miles of South Central Alaska, leveled entire communities, and triggered massive tsunamis that brought even more devastation to coastal areas. What House Bill 35 does is recognize a great disaster and how it brought out the best of all Alaskans by establishing March 27th as Great Alaska Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day. The purpose of the bill is not to highlight the quake necessarily, but to honor the thousands of Alaskans who put the needs of others before their own needs. First responders, medical personnel, the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, the U.S. Corps of Engineers, government employees, even ham radio operators are joined by everyday Alaskans to conduct search and rescue operations, provide medical care, food, shelter, and the restoration of vital infrastructure and services. It was their selfless determination that saved unknown numbers of lives and rebuilt South Central communities before the return of winter. The 1964 earthquake was also a watershed moment in the fields of geology, earth science, and more. It was a big part of what led to the creation of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, also known as FEMA, in 1979. This legislation means communities and civic groups can hold ceremonies around the state to mark a day that changed state history. And it also directs the governor to issue an annual proclamation commemorating Great Alaska Earthquake, Good Friday, Great Alaska Earthquake Remembrance Day, and to fly the state flag at half-mast. It also reminds Alaskans about the importance of building and designing safer structures, which a couple of our invited testifiers can speak to today. And Representative Millett respectfully asks for the committee's support for the legislation. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So hopefully we can get this through. I think there's we've got the bare majority here. And we'll go right to the invited testimony. I'm going to ask for about 2 minutes limit, just because we want to get this the bill on its way. Anybody online or here in the room? Here in the room. We'll take the person here in the room first.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Steve Masterman. I am Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, and I am just here to testify in support of this piece of legislation. At the Division, we feel it's important to remember those people that gave their lives in this great disaster, and also I think it's important for us to have a day on the calendar to remind people of the significance and the danger of earthquakes in Alaska. And as the previous speaker mentioned, to remind us that we need to build our infrastructure and our buildings to be able to withstand the potential effects of future earthquakes, and to design and plan our communities to be resilient to earthquakes and tsunamis. So we're very supportive of this piece of legislation. And with that, I'll answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions for Mr. Masterman? Thank you for being here this morning. Is there anybody else here in the room that wish to testify? Herman, did you have any comments? Okay. Off net, we have Chuck Vellante.
Can you hear me?
Yes, if you get a little closer to Mike and pretend you're on a ham radio, I guess.
Okay. I'm using a handheld phone. Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear, sir.
Okay, thank you. First of all, thank you, Honorable Chairman and Honored Committee members, for allowing me to speak to you on behalf of this House bill. I want to thank Representative Millett again for sponsoring House Bill 35. My name, again, like I said, I began this quest because of my love of Alaska's people, my mission with the Alaska Air National Guard, and the tragic loss of my flight crew. On the evening of March 27th, I was the Alaska National Guard flight dispatcher coordinating flight operations at QSR National Guard Base in Anchorage. We were a small unit with 10 aircraft, enough flight crews to put them in the air at any given time. Guard's mission was to mitigate civil emergencies whenever and wherever the mission took us, and very soon we would be severely tested. Governor Egan immediately activated all National Guard units after the quake struck, and we all began converging on QSR National Guard Base. Without hesitation, we began dispersing troops into neighboring communities to recover casualties, tend to those who were suffering, free those who may have been trapped in the rubble of their surroundings, and to ensure civil order. Few of us sat around a conference table, but communications were difficult. Darkness was upon us. We gathered what vital information we could and began loading supplies, equipment, putting necessary personnel on standby as we awaited first light. During those days, our administrative flight operation office consisted of a flight of four personnel. I'm the sole survivor. The other three died in a tragic crash on a humanitarian mission to the city of Valdez. Because we were a small unit, we operated more like close family than formal military command. All this, of course, very emotional to me. Scope of the quake is legendary. Nothing's had more impact on Alaska's people. Everything was forever changed. Valdez, Seward, Portage, Girdwood, and Chinigo Village virtually destroyed and suffered numerous fatalities. Anchorage sustained unimaginable devastation. Infrastructure was in shambles. But as devastating and ravaging as the quake and tsunamis were, is not the main focus of this event. The cornerstone remains the people of Alaska and how they rallied together without hesitation. First responders from all walks of life came together and formed the largest humanitarian relief contingent in state history. Troopers, members of the Corps of Engineers, medics, doctors, and many others too numerous to mention, all displayed a strong will of resilience, resolve, tenacity, and self-sacrifice. Like the phoenix of old, standing shoulder to shoulder, they arose from the ashes of death, destruction, and despair to rebuild their lives, cities, towns, villages, and communities, so that all those that follow would have a better life. History owes much to these people of yesterday. What a thriving state of Alaska and its citizens enjoy today is because they stand on those shoulders of the giants of the past. Their selfless sacrifice paid honor to the future, and now it's up to us to pay honor to those of the past. We should never forget, never take for granted, and always honor them. Committee members, you have my extreme gratitude for listening. If there are any questions, I'm more than willing to respond.
Any questions from the committee, including Senator McGuire, who joined us during your testimony. I didn't want to interrupt that. Appreciate your diligence and efforts in helping memorialize this event, which I'd like to say I had sharp memories of it, but I was about 2 years old.
Oh, I appreciate your comments very much, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Vellante. If it sounds like you had prepared testimony, please send that to us. I'd like that to be part of the official record as this bill moves forward.
I will do that.
Thank you, sir. Is there anybody else here? Anybody online? We'll go ahead and close public testimony. I see this is going to have some pretty big fiscal impact, Mr. Turner. I'm just kidding. Senator McGuire, I know you're not old enough nearly to have experienced the Alaska earthquake, but you've probably heard stories. But I'd like to give you the honor of moving the bill.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, it is an honor, and thank you for this bill. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill number 35 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes out of Senate State Affairs.
Hearing no objection, this leaves our committee one day before the actual event this year, but this is a permanent enshrinement, so would have been nice. We had technical problems last session, so did our best diligence. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you, Representative Millett, for her patience as we did our best to get this out, but still have a day. Thank you. That, we're going to go to the two measures and the countermand. We've had the public testimony and we've had some discussion, and our intent was to, we were having to facilitate some of the public testimony, introduction of the bill. The real work on this is in the Judiciary Committee, and we have two members on here. That's been our past discussion. That we had previously left public testimony open. Is there anybody that wished to testify on the bill? Mr. Coons, would you like to do some valedictory as this heads out to the next committee and we'll, before we make the motion, or do you want to just wave it through?
You were speaking to me, Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, I just got if I could, I sent an email to you with prepared testimony. I would like to state this. It takes about 2.5 minutes.
Go ahead. Please proceed.
My name is Mike Coons, National Director of Citizens Initiatives. I would like to read the following from Charles Kapowitz, our Executive Director, with comments from myself as well pertaining to the constant attack by Article 5 groups. For 30-plus years, I have watched Article 5 groups like John Birch, Eagle Forms, Constitution Party, and Libertarians make a mockery of the Article 5 process, and as a result of their flawed constitutional arguments, paralyze state legislators, keeping them from addressing serious problems America needed to remedy. In 1787, the first 13 state legislators created the federal government to serve the needs of the states. They left for future legislatures the sovereign authority to modify the conduct of the government when it encroaches on states and citizens' rights. Here are just a few of the damages these Article 5 groups have inadvertently caused. One, a national debt now reaching $18 trillion. Two, unfunded liabilities of $150 trillion. Three, America's energy industry has been crippled due to EPA, BLM executive orders. Four, Alaska and 37 other states, energy producing states have been severely restricted. Five million illegal immigrants legalized. Six, land grabs up to 50% of the state lands west of Mississippi being under federal control, 67% Alaska, 82% Nevada, 67% Utah, 50% North Dakota. State legislators are the most powerful and important government bodies in America. They are the final arbiters of all constitutional matters. The framers left for future generations of legislators the sovereign authority to protect our Constitution through Article 5, not throw it away based on poor constitutional analysis by these anti-Article 5 groups. All the above have damaged America generally, the states have suffered specifically, and even more, we the people have been directly impacted in the loss of our liberties and freedoms. Those damages to our national, state, and individual sovereignty could have been remedied through the state legislatures and through a sound and proper use of Article 5. And I'm open for any questions, and leave there.
I think you've done a pretty good job of talking to a lot of folks individually, Mr. Coons, and I know that's going to be a continued process. Appreciate the time that you spent as a citizen lobbyist here in Juneau and giving up one of your prized possessions to finance that trip. So that's citizen action in action. So I don't see any other questions. Thank you. And there's three members of that committee. We'll continue to be reviewing this on the next committee. So is there any other public testimony after the two previous hearings? And today we'll close the public testimony. We've done our due diligence. Senator Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the Senate Joint Resolution number 15 out of committee to the next committee referral with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
And looking forward to the three members here, two to my right and one to my left, continuing the analysis of the next committee referral.
Hearing no objection. Two of us are co-sponsors, so.
With that, the bill is moved out of committee with the individual recommendations. We'll just take a brief at ease. Thank you, staff, for catching us in our zeal to move the bills through. We need to, although they're traveling companions, procedurally, they're two separate measures. So, Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 4 deals with the delegations, and so I would move that we move the Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 4 from committee with individual recommendations in the attached zero fiscal note.
There are no objection. And our second motion?
That was it. We've done both of them now.
We moved the previous one.
Yep.
Okay. That will take a brief at ease again. State affairs back to order after those couple of brief recesses and getting our business correctly in order. Thank you again, staff. We have Senate Bill 22. Again, another delayed introduction. Welcome, sir. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, and I'm staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. today before you, Senate Bill 22, and I have some prepared remarks. I'll just go over real quickly. Since the inception of the motor vehicle registration tax system in 1993, the cost to the state of collecting these taxes for municipalities have been reduced considerably, while the rate they take off the top has not. The MVRT program was created not as a revenue sharing program between, but was intended to, it was intended to, in a sense, piggyback on the activities the state was already conducting in order to produce revenues for municipalities. With this understanding in mind, the state should only be collecting the added costs it incurs from operating the program, not sharing in the added revenues with the municipalities received from their citizens. SB 22 proposes to reduce the amount the state collects from 8% to 5.5% in order to more accurately reflect the amount of work and resources the state provides to the municipalities for performing this service. This does not impose any new costs or fees on the state or the citizens. It simply reallocates more of the collected funds to the cities themselves. By allowing local governments to keep more of their own taxes, this revenue is kept closer to the citizens it was intended to serve, and therefore serves the people better. With revenue sharing posed to be reduced in these difficult fiscal times, allowing the municipalities to retain more of their own revenues makes sense. And with me today, I have, Dan Moore, who's the treasurer of the Municipality of Anchorage, to kind of get a little more in depth with some of the issues. So I think he's online.
Mr. Moore.
He's in the
No. Okay. Is this going to be the municipality's only bite at the apple for some revenues?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I couldn't comment on that.
I think you can. You got another bill. Okay. The municipality is not going to comment on this, I guess. Ms. Erickson from Department of Administration.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm just here for questions.
Do you have a, here's a question. This has fiscal impact for the state. You guys are obviously also dealing with the deficit just as we are. Do you have any comments, concerns, statements, ponderings, or whatever?
This really won't affect DMV's operations at all, but it's true that this would affect the state's general fund, and whether the state can afford to forego approximately $500,000 a year is really a question for the legislature.
It's not anything really drastic like permanent registration, right?
Right.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would mention that the motor vehicle registration tax was actually established in 1978, and in 1993 it was amended to increase the amount the state retains instead of decrease. It began at 5% and in 1993 was raised to 8%.
We did have some useful things for the record after all. I appreciate that. So our administration folks have a wealth of information. They should not be so reticent. And maybe, any other questions for Ms. Erickson? Senator Lukowski.
Maybe somebody can explain to me the process of how this works. So you go on a DMV, and there's a fee assessed, and then does this result in more money going to the municipalities? There seemed to be that sort of statement made. Or explain to me how exactly this works. Either Amy or...
Mr. Wolf.
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. Yeah.
You're the advocate, so.
Obviously. So, Senator Wilkowski through the chair. That's correct. So you go into DMV and or you do it online or any other various methods, and you register in your vehicle. You need to do this, I guess, every 2 years for the state. And so the state already collects their fee, obviously, for registration. And there's 16 other municipalities that have enacted additional fees. And so right now, those fees, the state does the collecting for them, and they kind of put a big pot and then share it, and then delegate it to them. Later on, and what this does,
let's pick something like a driver's license. Like, I'm going in to buy a driver's license, and the fee set at, I don't even remember,
about 20
bucks, 10 bucks, something like that. And then, so we're not lowering the fee, are we?
Senator Bukowski through the chair, no, we're not lowering any fees. We're not changing any fees. We're simply changing the amount the state returns to the municipalities. So right now they collect 8% off the top as like an administrative fees for conducting this program, for taking the money in. So we're just lowering that from 8% to 5.5%. Because DMV is not actually doing any extra work per se than they're already doing, because they're really just, are you in any extra work collecting $200 versus $100? No, you're not. You're just, so that's what we're doing, is we're trying to bring it down to be more in line with the amount of work and costs associated with actually operating the program for the municipalities, so that they're not sharing in the revenues, really.
So I go into DMV and I want to get a new license. It's $10. So the fee doesn't change. I give my $10. Right now, 8% comes back to the state for management.
Senator Wilkowski through the chair, I don't think this applies to DMV. Driver's license. Registration fees. It applies to your vehicle registration. So
vehicle registration.
Yeah, just vehicle registration. So I'm pretty sure the licenses, those fees all still go to the state. So this is just the taxes that municipalities have enacted on their own to draw additional revenue, and this, the DMV just does the collecting for them when people register their vehicles at the DMV. They just do the work, I guess.
So I'm just trying to figure out how this money goes to the municipality then, as opposed to the state. I mean, it's a state-run operation, right? DMV? If I walk into DMV to get my vehicle registration renewed, that's a state operation.
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. Yes, you're correct, but I believe, Minister Erickson might be able to comment further on this, but I believe the state has already separate agreements with each municipality that they say, hey, you know, this is our percentage this is the amount that we charge, you know, for Anchorage, for example, and so therefore you will collect that money for us, take your 8% off the top, and then return the rest of that money to us. Does that make sense?
No.
Mr. Wolf, I'm sure you're familiar with the committee rules. You don't have a dialogue with one of the members. Are you aware of that?
I apologize.
Okay. We do like to keep it a little less formal for efficiency, but it's digressing into a chat between you and a member. And I know you know better than that.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. Sorry.
Totally my fault. Don't blame him.
Well, you're not curable.
That's a problem. That's probably true.
Ms. Erickson, and Senator Lukowski, would you like to clarify the question?
I would. Explain to me the process, if you could, Ms. Erickson, about how... Let's say I walk into DMV to get a vehicle registration, and how it works now, and how I just don't understand how the money's going to the municipality now, and how this would increase the money going to the municipality. Could you explain the process?
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. For example, in the municipality of Anchorage, my vehicle is 8 years old, and the motor vehicle registration tax applied by the municipality of Anchorage is $70. So I come in to DMV and I pay my $100 registration fee, which goes to the state, in addition to $70 that goes to the municipality. And of that $70, 8% is retained by the state, and the rest is refunded to the community. And of the 17 communities, they each have their own established motor vehicle registration tax. So it would range from $16, for example, to $70 for Anchorage and Metsu.
So if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
It's a $100 total fee, or 100 plus 70, and then I go in, pay my $100, and then you take off 8%, and the rest goes to this muni?
Through the chair, Senator Welkowski, the muni would get less than 8% of the $70. The state retains the $100 registration fee, which is in statute.
Just to shortcut it, no change in any of the fees. This is only directing the percentage for the transactional costs for being the tax collector.
Okay. But, and if I could, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the muni's not doing any more work for this, are they? I mean, it seems like the state's doing the bulk of the work, and the muni is completely not involved in this. Is that fair to say?
Is that a question for me?
Yes,
sir.
Yes, it is.
Through the chair, Senator Welkowski, I would say that is true. The state administers this program for each of the 17 municipalities.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. I was just going to, if I might, have permission to say an analogy to Senator Wilikowski.
Analogize away.
Okay, that it might help you. I was thinking about this is when we do school district appropriations, you know, there was a time period where we would go directly to the PTA. And part of that reason was to avoid the administrative fees that were collected by the muni. Or by the district, my apologies. And if this were a bill to affect that, then rather than saying we're going to appropriate to PTA and just completely cutting out school district, we might say instead of the 12.5% they take, we're going to reduce it to 8, something like that. I don't know if that helps you, but that's kind of the first analogy I thought of, was that administrative fees often can erode the base of the dollar that people are trying to collect for whatever the purpose is. So,
if I could, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So, can someone explain to me how this would impact the Anchorage property tax cap, if at all? Would it increase the property tax cap? Would it supplant property taxes? Do you have any sense, or maybe someone from the municipality?
Hang on, Ms. Erickson. We may come back to you, but we're going to be informal here and go to Mr. Moore. I think he is.
I am on the line.
Please go ahead and establish your identity for the record.
Okay. My name is Daniel Moore, and I'm the city treasurer in the municipality of Anchorage. In response to the question from one of the committee members, the auto registration tax, it's a payment in lieu of property tax. And so what we do is every dollar that we collect in auto registration tax for the municipality is a dollar decrease in the amount of property tax that is needed. When we increased our rate schedule, and it took effect in 2012, we nearly doubled our rates for auto registration tax. That was the first time we've had the program that our rates were increased. And at the time, it increased the auto tax registration revenues for Anchorage by about $5 to $6 million, and that meant $5 to $6 million less of property tax was needed. And so that's what happened, and we basically matched the MATSU's rates. So that's kind of what drove the change. The actual 8% fee, which hasn't changed since 1993, is to provide the cost recovery for DMV to administer the program. The problem is that once we increased our rate schedule in 2012, we used to pay 45% of the entire program, DMV program costs, which makes sense because we have 45% of the vehicles. Today, we pay 59% of all the costs of the motor vehicle registration program, but we still only have 45% of the vehicles. So it's a mathematical problem that when we increased our rates, that all of a sudden we paid double the amount of administration fee, even though we didn't get any additional service. So it's been a windfall to DMV. It's extra revenue that they never had to operate on before. Their budget actually went up. Their available funds to operate this program went up 59% as a result of what Anchorage did with its rate schedule. So they're getting $500,000 more per year, and it's a surplus. So we're trying to correct the situation by lowering the fee from 8% down to 5.5%. What you do is you basically say to DMV, you're not going to retain as much money. You're going to retain a little over $1 million like you used to for years and years. So it's just going back to what they used to operate off of. And then with that extra $500,000, they're going to spread that across the state. And so the municipality of Anchorage, we're not going to fully recover our $500,000. We'll recover $300-some thousand. Matsu will recover $100,000. And depending on your population size, it'll get dispersed. But every single community, all 16, 17 communities, will basically get a bump up in their net revenues coming from DMV of about 3%. And that's significant across the state. So it's less money concentrated with DMV, and it's reallocated to all these different communities so they have more money to provide local services or to reduce property taxes. So that's the point behind the proposed legislation.
Mr. Moore, we've established on the record pretty clearly that the state is overly gouging the recipient of the title or registration, and I don't know how much comfort my constituents going to have if they're paying their whatever amount it is, been $220 or whatever the amount is. I think their hearts are going to be warm that the muni's getting it their money instead of the state. I think they're going to think it's government. And do you guys ever think about maybe taking that 1.5% of skim? And I know it seems to be consistent with other people's philosophy, and maybe just not charging the people. I mean, the bottom line is my constituent doesn't care which government's taking their money. So, but I've had this argument with the municipality and the mayor, and the property taxpayers lost, and the vehicle registry payers lost, so I understand where the balance of power is. But what about giving it back to the people? First, I'll ask the sponsor's representative, and then Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have any comment on that at this time.
You don't have a deep bed philosophy about where the money belongs to?
I wouldn't feel comfortable putting that
okay.
on the record right now.
Okay, Mr. Moore.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thanks for the question. I would say the difference between the city and the state, the city of Anchorage, is that we have a tax cap and it's set by charter. And so when we get any type of tax, and this is an auto registration tax, and we get more of that tax, we have, by charter, we have to take that into account within our cap. So what it means is we have more money coming in for auto registration tax, and by definition, that means less money being charged by property tax. And the one good thing about auto registration tax is a lot broader base of people pay that tax than do property tax. So it actually works very well in Anchorage because we have a tax cap and because we're legally required to offset auto registration tax increases with property tax decreases.
Well, I understand the government aspects and how it works for government, but I guess I'll continue, like I say, with other legislation, be concerned with the folks paying it, because I don't think they give a rip to which government entity it goes to. They're writing the check, but I think I'll just leave it at that. Any other questions from committee members? Any other public testimony on this bill? I think the crux of this one will be the fiscal issue, and it's certainly appropriate for the finance. This does have a further referral to the Finance Committee. So I put my concerns or statements on the record. I'm certainly willing to move the bill forward.
haven't dealt with a lot of good faith in the municipality of Anchorage on a lot of issues, but this might be one I'll just give in on and let this be fought out upstairs. So, I assert I don't think the public really cares whether or not Bill Walker and the legislature is getting the money or Mayor Sullivan is getting the money. They're writing the check and it's government. So this may warm somebody's hearts, but I'm not sure whose. So
yeah, interesting.
We've got the fiscal note. It would have members seen the fiscal note? It would be a shift of revenues from the state to the municipalities, and that would be a discussion in the Finance Committee, and we'll certainly discuss this when we do the Department of Administration budget closeout today as well, as this is a vehicle moving. It does have a fiscal note. Now, who knows what happens to bills with fiscal notes in this environment, but it won't be slowed down here. Senator Coghill.
I just wanted to associate myself with your remarks on the individuals in Alaska. I appreciate that, but it is a finance issue. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we move Senate Bill number 22 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objection? Hearing none, the bill moves somewhere besides here. Out of committee. One brief at ease. Going to step affairs back to order. Welcome. Special privilege to have my successor in the House district. It has had three numbers in the last 2 years. Currently, District 12. Glad to be so ably represented. You represent Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Tilton. I represent House District 12. Before you today, I bring HB 93, which is a piece of a continuing legislation on our ongoing reforms of Alaska's criminal justice and correction systems. If I may, I would like to thank Senator Coghill for letting me work with him last year on SB 64 and for allowing me to carry this bill this session. The cost of, as we all know, Alaska has held one of the highest rates of recidivism, and the cost of keeping a prisoner in jail is over $150 a day, with the cost continuing to rise. It is a fact that in our budget climate today that our state cannot afford to build another prison. HB 93 builds on the bipartisan efforts of the legislature that we have started to move the needle on recidivism. In 2011, 52% of probationers did not complete their court orders of release and return back to prison. Those reforms have been in place, that we've been putting in place, have helped to lower that number to 45% in 2014. Those who work with probationers, such as
partners... I need to interrupt you. What percentage don't get their probation interrupted?
52% in 2011 didn't complete their court order conditions, and we have, with some of the reforms that we've been putting in place from 2011 to 2014, has lowered the number to 45%.
They're doing their full sentence just on installment then.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Those who work with probationers, such as Partners in Progress, have identified employment as being one of the three largest components, with employment being number one. The other two are housing and social services to help them through their transitioning. But what we do know is that few employers are willing to hire somebody that has a record. So we have a little challenge there. As a matter of fact, there is a study with the Urban Institute that showed that just 12.5% of employers said that they would definitely accept an applicant with a criminal record. What HB 93 does, it encourages this employment by making it clear to probation officers that when they are scheduling the probation appointments, that they use diligent effort to schedule around the person's employment, thereby allowing the probationer to be successful in their employment. This bill also allows the probationer's reasonable travel in-state to work as long as it is not in conflict with the terms of the conditions of their probation. It's a building block and another tool in our tool chest. By keeping probationers employed, we give them the opportunity to give back to the system. We reduce the draw on our health and social services budget and the cost to our state when a prisoner recidivates, so ultimately and potentially saving a lot of dollars to our state. I appreciate your hearing HB 93 and can answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions, initial round here? We'll probably want to, this, given this is a House bill that's already passed, and we have some very similar legislation coming, I'd like to maybe discuss that at the same time. So I think we're going to be getting your legislation fairly soon.
Okay.
In this committee. So, do you want to hear from Ms. Belden? You can say where you are. I believe she's calling in. Ms. Belden from the Department of Corrections. Any initial comments? Department of Corrections? They might be in a lockdown up there.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. DOC doesn't have any testimony, and we're just here to answer any questions if you'd like. Thank you.
I would, you know what, I really would like to hear comments from corrections. We have, generally, that's the purpose of this committee process, and, you know, the darndest thing, Department of Administration didn't have any comments, yet they had a very useful part of our committee dialogue that was critical or deliberations. I hate to waste your time having you sit here and then not to participate. I know you've the Department of Corrections has had to have had some conversations with the sponsor. Please, I don't want no sense having people show up if they're going to be throttled and can't talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the DOC does support this bill, and the sponsor has worked with us on this bill, and we do appreciate that. And we do believe that work is an employment is a very, very important protective factor, and that is something that is vital to keeping our population of probationers and parolees on the straight and narrow and out of trouble. So we do think work and employment is a very, very vital part of the reentry process.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I think I like the bill. Maybe some of the details of it I'm curious about. So if someone is commits a crime, is in prison in Anchorage or Fairbanks, and then they get a job on the slope, and they have a two-week on, two-week off cycle, or they get a job in rural Alaska where they're there maybe for 6 months, how do you deal with the issue of checking in with the probation or parole officer?
We actually come into that scenario quite often, and our probation and parole officers do value employment, and we just try to schedule those meetings when they're in town. And we also do telephonic meetings. We very much try and accommodate their schedules already.
Any follow-up, sir?
I know there's a bill that seeks to, that Senator Cockhill is doing, which I think looks like a good bill, which seeks to have more electronic monitoring, and I assume that's going to be a problem in many communities where, or is it not? In rural Alaska, some rural communities, do you see an issue with that?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. Will electronic monitoring be a problem? I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, I guess simply put, the issue that I see arising potentially from this is you have people that go off to work in either remote communities or the slope, which is great. You know, we want people to get jobs. I think it's critical to their success in rehabilitation. It seems like we're making a move towards more electronic monitoring. And can you electronically monitor people in rural Alaska and on the slope? I guess that's my question.
Yes, we can, and we do currently.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, and this is probably for the Department of Corrections. I don't know if it's a term of art, but the word diligent is used here, diligent efforts to secure, maintain steady employment. And can you describe how you would use that word, diligent efforts? Should we put active efforts? So help me understand that part, because it's central to what we're doing.
And I'd like to ask Ms. Daigle to also join us up here, so I know she works directly with Commissioner Taylor, and she can probably add some things.
Mr. Chairman, this for Department of Corrections. I was just wondering if that was a term of art. It has a little more flexibility probably in it, the word diligent, but it also could be very subjective. And has that been a question? And I'm sorry to Representative Tilton, maybe the question should have started there, because that is one of the key parts, as I see, of accountability in here. Have you thought through is it a term of art? Is it something that they already do under efforts by parolees? And I'm sorry, I should have probably asked this somewhere earlier before we got here, but that is a key element to this.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, this is the first time that word has specifically been brought up, and it is something that we should consider and talk with the department on.
And it's referenced in your sponsor statement as well, so it must mean something. Ms. Daigle?
For the record, my name is Sherry Daigle. I'm the Special Assistant to Commissioner Taylor with the Department of Corrections. And I think the diligent efforts of the probation officers is where that comes in. They are constantly working with the probationers to help them and assist them in obtaining employment. I'm not sure why it doesn't say active, but we can certainly look into them.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, I'm not looking for an answer today, but it just came to my attention as I was reading it, and I've worked with these words. Accountability is a big deal to parole officers, but flexibility is also a big question in if they're working. But diligent is very subjective compared to active, and this is something to think about. I'll put the question on table. I don't need an answer today, but I'll work through it.
What do they use for securing unemployment compensation?
Yeah.
Senator Milikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. What do you do about the probationer who the probation officer thinks is game in the system? So, you know, just wants to go out and fool around, wants to be away from this probation officer somewhere out and got relatives maybe off the grid. With this bill, we're putting requirements on the probation officer that they shall permit each probationer to travel. So how do you deal with that situation?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the probation officers are very keen to some of the tactics that some people use. Most people on probation are not going to do that. They're going to seek employment. They're going to go through the right avenues to stay employed. But for those that you're speaking of, the probation officers are aware of those. They follow them very closely. It was a concern that this bill did say that they shall allow the travel permit, but I think that was the intent of the sponsor, was that it should be granted.
So just a follow-up. So if because it does say shall, it says shall permit each probationer to travel in the state to make different efforts. And let's say the probation officer says, no, I think you're just going off to get away from monitoring, and I don't think you should do that. And the probationer says, well, that's what the law says, I can go. How do, you know, since we got shall in there, who solves that dispute?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we do not know. And that has been a discussion that has come up, but we're not sure.
Mr. Chair, how do we fix this so that we don't get in that situation?
This is never litigated, is it?
No.
Well, it's not yet because it's not on the books, but I guarantee you it will be.
Senator Coghill, Chairman, to add to that question.
Yeah, Section 2...
Or shows, the confusion or whatever.
Yeah, no, Section 2 talks about what the parolee is responsible to do, and I think this bill, from my first reading of it, it falls into the category of you know, why does government do that? For example, the parole officer sometimes is more concerned about what they're doing than what the parolee is doing. And this is just an insertion, it looks like to me, that they have to accommodate them if work is the issue. And but then, as Senator Wilkowski said, we always have to think of what's the gaining of the system part. I'm open to that discussion, but I guess from my own personal experience, I've seen where the parolee has to report to certain places, and quite often it comes right out of their work schedule. So I think this is, it looks to me like it's putting a requirement on the parole officer, and I just want to make sure that I understand that. I don't really have a question so much as a comment, that it looks to me like the requirement at this point is to have to take the work schedule into account. And maybe the sponsor of the bill has a comment on that.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, yes, that is the end.
I have just a basic understanding question. As I understand probation and parole, and please correct my rudimentary understanding, is it all an administrative procedure within the parole board and the administrative process with corrections, or does this get kicked up to the courts? How is this, as a practical matter, how is this handled?
Through the Chairman,
go ahead.
Sorry about that. Actually, Carrie Belden would be the best person to answer that question. The court is involved in probation and parole.
And to what level, how frequently involved, and at what level does this get turned over where it's an administrative procedure that through the parole board or through the correction probation thing? That said, help me understand this a little bit.
Absolutely, and I think Carrie Belden would be
great.
The best person to answer that.
Ms. Belden, did you hear my mumbling question?
For the chair, I believe I did. So what happens is the parolee or probationer and the probation officer would sit down and have their office visit. They would, during their office visit, they go ahead and schedule the next office visit that they'll be seen at. And they do talk about work schedules and try and keep that into mind. And you know, obviously the early morning, the lunchtime office visits and the end of the day office visits are probably the easiest for everybody, but you know, there's only so many of those to go around. So the PO does try and be fair about work schedules because they do want them employed. And the court and the parole board come into play when there are violations. When the PO has tried to work with that probation employee and tried to handle things informally, and if it gets to a point where the PO, the violations are too big, or the PO is just not getting anywhere with that probation employee, then they will file a petition to revoke probation or a parole violation and bring that probation or employee before the court or before the board. So they try to do it administratively and handle it just through meeting with the probation or employee. And if it can't be handled at that level, that's when it goes to the bigger level of the parole board or the court.
I have one other question. Is it a common parole condition, consumption of alcohol or possession of alcohol? How common is that, or is it, and has it been tested in the courts?
No alcohol to excess is a general condition that all of the probation employees get. The no alcohol consumption, meaning zero tolerance, is a case-by-case basis, and that depends on the probation or parolee's history and crime and specific, it's specific to them.
So I guess my follow-up question is, we have another substance that's supposed to be regulated like alcohol. Do you think that's upholdable to put conditions on on marijuana, for example, if we were going to regulate it like alcohol?
Yes, if the parole board or the court does not want a probationer or parolee to ingest marijuana, then they can put a specific specific condition on that says no marijuana consumption.
Even under the new paradigm where it might be legal, or it is legal, I guess, as we're going through. Is that same answer?
Yes, sir, yes. That's just like alcohol is legal for most, but they can put on that prohibition condition if they choose. So marijuana would be legal for most, but they can put on that marijuana prohibition if they choose.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So here's the two scenarios that I see happening. Number one, probation officer says, no, I don't think you should go to travel. And then the probationer gets an attorney, and they go to court. And the attorney says, well, the law says you shall permit them. So explain what happens, what's likely to happen, and maybe we need a alleged legal to come in and weigh in on this. Explain what's likely to happen in that situation. And then the other situation is the person goes, and then the probation officer wants to get them back, and then it goes before a judge as well. So, maybe just talk about how the courts you expect would deal with that situation.
Through the chair, that is something that is a concern. By placing shall in there, the discretion of the PO is then removed. So that might be an issue. I don't know how big of an issue. Maybe legal could talk about how big of an issue. I don't know if it will be liability issues as far as the department getting sued for not letting people go when they feel like they should. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question because we haven't stumbled upon it yet. But that is a very real consideration. If maybe it's not in that person's best interest to travel and to go on that path, but then the bill says, the law says that they shall go. So, but we try to work things out informally and try to get a happy middle. Worst case scenario, that person would end up before the court or the parole board about that.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
It looks to me that it would still have to be consistent with the other terms of probation. So the board still has, I think, some pretty significant leeway here by setting other conditions. And so maybe the sponsor can speak to that. It looks to me like they're ordered to take it into account, but they're also ordered to keep it consistent.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, yes, it is clearly stated that when it is not in conflict with the other terms and conditions of their probation, and we did discuss this issue in a previous committee, and we did work with the department and with legal to try to come up with some other wordage that might be able to clarify that a little bit better, and it ended up that we working with legal, there just wasn't another workaround, and so we went ahead and just went with the bill as it was, and looking at this, that it is not in conflict with the other with terms of their conditions of probation.
Thank you. I don't intend to hold a judiciary hearing on the bill, but it's hard not to, and but this is our only crack at it, and I guess my main thing I hope after it leaves is we clearly put on the record. That's my, well, actually, I'll ask the question is, do you view probation as a qualified privilege or a right? The sponsor and then the department.
A qualified privilege?
Yeah. Ms. Daigle?
Chairman Stoltz, I would agree. The department would agree.
And I understand our reformation provision in our Constitution as well, but I just want to make sure in our zeal to try to empty our prisons, we don't let the wrong ones out. Senator Wilkowski.
Does this have a judiciary referral?
It does, yes. If it doesn't, it deserves one, that's for sure. I believe it does.
Okay.
Let me see.
Chairman Stoltz, yes, it does have a judiciary referral.
So, again, we won't overly hold a judicial hearing, but probably won't hurt, actually, to have the two eyes that aren't on judiciary get a good look at it as well. So, any other questions? There are a few other issues, obviously, and now we're going to want to how this fits into the other legislative efforts as well. And this one actually looks perhaps more ripe for passing this year than perhaps the one that was just dropped. So, but we've probably some value of having the two travel together as well, though. If there are any other questions, if there aren't any other questions, we'll set it aside with a sincere intent to get right back to this as quick as we can. You understand some of the questions and follow-ups we need to do, and we'll work with your staff.
Thank you, Chairman Stoltz.
This one we'd like to have, I know he's got a lot of polls. We'd like polls of his time in other places. This one we'd like to have the commissioner on the record making, given that experience in the Department of Corrections, Commissioner Taylor's began in probation, and I think we'd to be depriving ourselves of a strong voice with a lot of authority if we didn't have Commissioner Taylor here himself at the hearing in this committee.
Chairman Stoltz will make that happen.
So with that, we'll work in advance, so I won't expect him to show up on short notice. He's running a little department as well. With that, appreciate the... We have got quite a few measures out today. Appreciate that. And we will conclude our business here shortly after 10 a.m.